It's March 10th, 2016, and I'm Nicole Barnes for the Oral History Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I'm here with Jude Limer, who's the managing editor of the History Cartography Project. And we're sitting in Science Hall and doing an interview on the History of Cartography Project. So, thanks, Jude.
Happy to be here.
Okay. Do you mind spelling your last name for the record?
My last name is Limer, L-E-I-M-E-R.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Do you want to open up by starting a little bit with your childhood and family, where you grew up, where you were born?
I was born in New York, and as a young elementary school student, my brother and I and my family moved to Minnesota. So I grew up my formative years in Rochester, Minnesota. My parents are both from New York City. And we did place a huge expectation, or value, I should say, on education. My father was a mechanical engineer and had several advanced degrees. And there was always an expectation that my brother and I would go to college, although in those days, in the early 1970s, it wasn't really spoken about a lot. We didn't talk about going to college. I think it was an unstated expectation, and certainly my brother and I were excited about that and planned on it, but there weren't a lot of family conversations about it. So my brother went to a small liberal arts college in Minnesota. I did the same. I went for 2 years to Augsburg College. Didn't take a lot of college tours like I did with my kids. I just selected it. I knew someone there. It seemed appropriate. And I had a great 2 years there. And then I took a semester abroad on World Campus Afloat, which is a ship that sails different semesters to different locations. The year I went, it was a fall semester. We went through the Mediterranean, West Africa, and the Caribbean. And I came back and dropped out of school and took a year off and worked, and then decided to go back to finish my education. And at that point, I had developed a great interest in travel and other cultures and other peoples, so geography seemed like a good fit for me. So I enrolled at the University of Minnesota, and I finished there with a bachelor's degree in geography.
Did you have any idea what you wanted to do after?
Absolutely none. Absolutely none. And it was a different thought about education maybe than some people have today. I didn't go to school so that I would prepare myself for a job. I just wasn't thinking along those lines. I tried to take courses in all kinds of areas and see what my interests were. And it turned out that one of my great interests was maps, and I had a great fascination with maps, and it fit in well with geography. But realistically, I didn't know very much about maps. I didn't know anything about the history of maps. But I did decide I wanted to continue my education, and that's what brought me to UW, to Madison, because I wanted to get a master's degree, and this was an important place to study.
Okay. So this was the only place you looked, and did you know about David Woodward before you came here, or?
I came here before David Woodward.
Oh, there you go.
I came here in the fall of 1979. And I came here because it was one of the premier cartography programs. It had a stellar collection of faculty members. Arthur Robinson, of course, was still here when I came, and I got to take one class from him, which was wonderful. Phil Murky was here, Joel Morrison, Randy Sale, all what were at that time were considered the big names in cartography. David came the year after I came, and Robinson retired. So they sort of switched, and David came into Robinson's position. So that was the reason to come here, and those faculty members were really influential in my experience here, all of them, and they were all very highly thought of scholars of cartography.
With whom did you work most closely with?
With David once he came,
okay.
Because at that point I had decided I wanted to do a thesis. At that time the department had thesis and non-thesis options. So for people who wanted to work as cartographers, perhaps for the federal government or something, many of them opted not to write a thesis, but I really wanted to write a thesis. So I worked with David, and I was his first graduate student. And so that's how I hooked up with him.
What was your thesis topic, and how did your research go?
It was interesting. I chose a modern topic, mapping for newspaper maps in the United States, mm-hmm. and I wanted to look at how they were done, how they were produced, the physical and technical aspects, but also just what they looked like and how they were used and how much information people seemed to be able to garner from them. So I worked with David, and he was a perfect advisor for me. He was very, very encouraging, very supportive, but not very controlling. He let me choose the direction the topic was going to go and figure that out for myself. Wasn't prescriptive about what needed to be included or not included, but very demanding on writing, and felt that certainly that was a minimum, that your writing would be good and tight and grammatically correct. And he made a wonderful little chart for me when he read my thesis, and the chart had two columns. One column was Jude's spelling, and the other column was Webster's spelling. And that was his humorous way of saying, be more careful about your spelling. I had several spelling errors in my thesis, and he managed to find, I'm sure, every single one. So he was very demanding about writing, mm-hmm. and very helpful that way, and worked out well for me.
So in those early years of David's tenure at UW, had he already thought of the idea of the History of Cartography project? Do you know anything about how that got started, or how did you connect with the history?
Well, David and Brian Harley, the co-founders of the project, were both geographers, historians of geography, historians of cartography. They had different skill sets, but they were both in the field. And they were friends, very different approaches to the discipline, but both of them... And there's a longer history, but the main history is that they decided they wanted to do, and we needed, a fuller history of cartography. And in 1977, they took a proverbial walk in the British countryside and decided that they would put this history together. And they thought it would be 4 volumes, and it would not take more than 10 years of their lives, which of course proved to be absolutely untrue. But that was the start. So that was in 1977. David came here to Madison in 1980, So the plans had already been laid between he and Brian. I was not involved with him. I didn't get involved with the project until David and Brian got their first NEH grant, which was 1981. And that grant money came to Madison so that David could hire a office manager and start work on the History of Cartography project. And then he hired some graduate students to do some additional work. We started out making suggestions for reference maps and collecting place names for the volume, the first volume that was going to be published, and put that all together. So that's when I hooked up with the project, more as a, I was still a graduate student, and more as a student hourly mm-hmm. helper. Mm-hmm. So the plans were already laid, and much changed in the following years.
Right. So how did that transition work from you being a student hourly to a staff member?
That's a good question. It was gradual. I took on more and more responsibility, and David needed more and more different staffing. There were different staffing needs as time went on, and David was always one to adjust and hire people when he thought they could help advance the cause. And so I became, and then I stuck around for a long time and just became more and more a part of the project, and eventually became the managing editor. I don't even know exactly when I got that title. It just happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So David was managing in Madison, and how involved was Brian Harley? He was based in Milwaukee, so were they co-leading? And
The relationship between David and Brian was always very tight, mostly between them, the staffing in Madison. We didn't interact a lot with Brian. especially because initially Brian was in England. So David and Brian corresponded with handwritten notes, which they mailed to each other, letters, phone calls when things had to be discussed immediately. So they kept in very close touch and decided, you know, the parameters of what was going on with the project. The staff here worked pretty much exclusively with David. It was 1986 when Brian moved to Milwaukee. And then we did, he came to Madison. He's only an hour away. He came to Madison. I went there and worked with him. David went there. So there was more personal interaction. And again, he and David always stayed in close touch about everything that was going on with the project.
What was David's managing style like? How did he lead the office, and how many people were working away on Volume 1 at that time?
Well, David was really a quiet, thoughtful, steady person. He was a very good listener. He was open to other people's ideas and suggestions. But he also was a leader, and he also decided what was going to happen and how it was going to happen and what was going to be done when by whom. So he was very pleasant to work for because he was genuinely a nice person who listened to people and also took responsibility and leadership when that needed to happen. So again, for me, you know, a very, very good person to work for. So during Volume 1, he ran the Madison office, and again, we interacted with Brian somewhat, but mostly with David. The early years working on Volume 1 seem almost hard to remember, hard to believe. We had what was the first word processing machine I ever used. We had a CPT with 8-inch floppy disks, and manuscripts for Volume 1 would come in, and they had to be entered into the word processor. They had to be typed in. We had people who did that. I did some of it, and other people did as well. And then we had to proofread the entries. Or they weren't entries then. They were articles, short articles. And then David and Brian would read them. And David and Brian interacted mostly with the authors to say, I'd like to add this, or what about that? The staff didn't do much of that. And we were just getting a system for looking at references and how things were going to be done, how they were going to be designed, how we were going to edit the footnotes and things like that. So we really just started from scratch and figured out what to do. It seems like we have a pretty good system now, but it's taken 35 years to get that system up and running. So David and Brian did most of the dealings with the authors. The staff, I would say we weren't particularly critical readers. We were simply trying to make sure there weren't any typos in the references and the text. We couldn't get many of the articles and books that were cited by authors because they were old or ancient and there was no internet to view these artifacts. So we did what we could do. It's changed dramatically since then. One thing we did learn, though, was although we could not get a lot of references in older books or see copies of them, we learned that the UW has a fantastic library, and there were many, many things that we were able to view because Madison owned them or they were in an associated library within the Wisconsin system. And that was surprising to us. I had never worked with the library so closely, and I was just amazed at the holdings that we have. And I can't imagine trying to do the project without a good library. So that was wonderful. I do remember that during our first years, the library got its first photocopy machine. And the copies were really crummy. They were dark black, but they were copies. Like, you could take something and copy it for, I don't know, a quarter, a page or something. And that was a revelation to us. all these things we take for granted now.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the staff was small, and we all tried to figure out what needed to be done and work toward completing Volume 1.
Mm-hmm. Were there specific roles? Like, we have an illustrations editor and reference editors. Did those exist in the beginning, or were people kind of had their hands in a lot?
They developed over time. It started out, we did have an office manager who was Mo Riley, who was a fantastic, outwardly cheerful, always extroverted person. She was really this great balance to David, who was very reserved and quiet, and she had just an infectious, loud laugh. And she and David got along great. And she really managed the office at the beginning and managed sort of the manuscript, moving things, having students work on references or things like that, the reference maps. There were several of us, maybe 2 to 3 of us, who did sort of hourly work to put the reference maps together. And then we started reading and helping in other ways. So there weren't super defined roles until we got most of Volume 1 together, and we started to focus pretty clearly on the illustrations, which we hadn't spent a whole lot of time on. And then Matthew came on board as, I think he was the first quote-unquote illustrations editor, someone that we hired to, I mean, someone that whose job it was to do illustrations. Everyone else sort of, at the beginning, sort of chipped in wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And then roles got more firmly defined as we moved on to later volumes.
Mm-hmm. And what was Volume 1? What did it cover?
You put me on the spot.
Sorry.
What's the title? Ancient, Medieval, and the Mediterranean and North Africa. How much time do we cover? Classical, Ancient, Medieval, all the way up through the Middle Ages in the Mediterranean area and North Africa. So up through the Middle Ages.
That's a big chunk of time.
It's a big chunk of time. But we didn't have to deal with a lot of continents.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true. And so how did the volume connect with the University of Chicago Press? Who kind of made those?
The key player there was Penny Kasalian. And she was an associate director at the press. And I don't know if David knew her or she knew David. I don't know who actually contacted who. I don't know the story behind that. But she was always our champion at the press. She loved the project. She wanted the press to do the project. She was a good friend of David's, and she was a supporter all the years she was with the press. She left the press in 2001, and she was just a fantastic a champion for us. So that was the connection, and I don't really know if David knew her or she knew David.
Mm-hmm. So the original plan was to get the project done in 10 years. When did Volume 1 come out, and how long is that since?
What was the publication year?
Is it 87?
87, yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I know I can depend on you. 87, so we got the first grant in 81, and it was published in 87.
Okay. So that's a big chunk of time. How did everyone process that, or come to an understanding that this project was going to take a lot more time than it initially was intended?
Well, for most of us working on the project, there wasn't a concern about how long it took.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we just wanted to get the work done. The timing was more David and Brian's, under their control. And certainly for Volume 1, many times David and or Brian both would say, this is going to take a little longer, but this is the first volume and it has to be right. And that came up even at the very end when we were going into production for Volume 1. David said, we really should have a bibliographical index. And I said, a what? We have to have an index of everything cited in the book? Why would we want that? He explained why he thought it would be a valuable tool. And I thought, oh, it's going to put us back like another 3, 4, 5, 6 months. He's like, yep, but I think we need it. And this first volume is setting the whole stage for all the other volumes, so it has to be right. And so we went back and compiled that and added that to the copy editing duties at the press. And then production for these volumes also takes much longer than perhaps any of us would anticipate. Certainly for volume one, which was still in the days of paste up on layout boards, mm-hmm. where they cut with an X-Acto knife the type out of galley pages and positioned the text, the footnotes, the image, and the caption on each and every page of the book, and then photographed it to make the plates. It was a labor-intensive job. And so I think the realistic idea that it could be done quickly was soon proved wrong. And I think everyone accepted that. I think the editors accepted it in terms of, we want this to be as good as it can be, and if it takes more time, it takes more time. And the staff, I think, we were just working to complete it, and I certainly wasn't thinking, oh, you know, this is taking... I mean, I knew it was taking a long time, but I wasn't thinking the repercussions of that for the rest of the series. I was only focused on trying to get volume one done. Mm-hmm. That's all I was thinking about. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even sure what would come next in terms of publishing.
So in the 80s, you were only working on volume one?
The first half of the 80s.
Okay.
Till about 85. It probably went to press. If it was published in 87, probably went to press in 85.
Mm-hmm. So you were working on volume two at that time?
And a little of volume three.
Really? Oh, wow.
We were moving to volume two. I think in the initial plans, and someone else who interviews here may have... remember this differently, but I think in the initial plans, a lot of, if not all, of the non-Western traditions were going to be wedged into volume one. They knew that they wanted to cover Chinese mapping. Mei Ling Shu, who was a professor at the University of Minnesota, had written about some very old Chinese maps. So they knew there was material, but as I remember it, there was no thought that there would be an entire volume devoted to indigenous or non-Western traditions. And certainly the fact that they then broke up into three separate books, I don't think that was anticipated by any of us. So volume three, which, you know, had actually sort of gotten slightly off the ground, was set aside to finish up the volume two books.
And volume three covers the...
European Renaissance.
Okay. Okay. So, you guys are plugging along on several projects, and then in the early 1990s, Brian dies abruptly. Did that have an impact on people thinking that the project could be completed? How did it influence David and the staff?
You know, I wish I had some more insights into how it actually influenced the project. I know it dramatically influenced David, both professionally and personally. But in terms of the project, I don't ever remember a time when, after Brian's death, you know, going through weeks of incredible sadness about it, I don't ever remember feeling like the project was going to end, or that it wasn't going to continue. And I think that was just David's way of dealing with it. I mean, we didn't talk about it a lot. There were other people who stepped up, and David did seek out other people to help with editing. And he and Brian may have sought out those exact same people together. But it was much more of a personal loss for David. The rest of us just sort of followed his lead, and his leadership was, we're doing this thing, and we just kept on. And I don't remember, but I know it had a dramatic effect. Mm-hmm. I just don't have much insight into what those effects really were.
Right, but they could be felt in certain ways. So then from the early 90s until 1998, you got all three books of Volume 2 out. And those, I think, you guys had a lot of issues with language difficulties and references, since, as you mentioned, you're covering indigenous groups across the world.
Volume 2 was a really different animal, all three books. What made it work and what was really incredibly valuable, and of course it was David's insight and Brian's too, was they brought on board editors and associate editors and postdoctoral men and women to help put these volumes together. And those people acted as the authors for many of the chapters and also as the advisors to David and Brian as to what needed to be covered and what material there was. And it's really due to those people that those volumes are so incredibly full and rich. Joe Schwartzberg, you know, sort of the man who knows everything about, it seems, South Asia, and he also did many of the work, all the work that we have on Southeast Asia in the history. And Gerald Tibbetts did Islamic chapters. Ahmet Kara Mustafa did Ottoman Turkish. I should look at my list because I don't want to forget anybody, because there were so many people. When we did the Chinese section, Cordell Yi was here in Madison for several years. He wrote many of those chapters. And then, of course, Malcolm Lewis co-edited book three with David. So without those people, those volumes don't come to fruition. The material is rich. There's things that certainly were out of all of our comfort zones in terms of languages, characters, just Vietnamese diacritics, you know, I mean, just so many things that we needed external and expert advice on, and there were people available to do that. Knowing very little about the cultures and the religions of these groups, and so for the volumes to come together, we needed those editors, associate editors, assistant editors, and postdocs who all contributed. Mm-hmm.
So you've mentioned there a list of really prominent historians of cartography. How, I imagine that David forged a lot of those relationships. How do you have any idea how he did that? Was it through conferences or?
You know, I don't. I think David was a very personable, although quiet man. And he certainly reached out and forged friendships and scholarly relationships with people who were in the history of cartography. It's not a large group of scholars. The semiannual, biannual conference has maybe 250 people who attend. So it's a small group, and so David and Brian sought those people out. And certainly some of the postdoc were not known people. Cordell Yi and Ahmet Kara Mustafa came as postdocs and worked in Madison and wrote chapters for us and helped with editing. And David put out an advertisement looking for a postdoc in these areas and got two wonderful people who really moved the volumes along. And for Volume 3, we also had postdocs as well. So David sought out young scholars that way by finding the money for postdoctoral positions so they could help. And then with the older established historians of cartography and geographers, he forged those relationships himself, knowing who these people were.
Mm-hmm. So were postdocs funded by the graduate school?
I would have to look back at the budget to see where the different funding sources were. I'm sure some of them were in our grants.
Okay. So that's how you did that. So Volume 2, all three books were completed in 1998. Had you already begun thinking about Volume 3 at that point, or?
We had some of the Volume 3 chapters before we finished Volume 1.
Wow.
It goes back a little to my memory, which I hope is accurate, about Volume 2 not really assuming there would be a volume two and thinking the volume two material would be fit into other volumes in other places when there was European contact. Or so after the Middle Ages, it was going to be followed by the Renaissance. And that is a particular area that was going to have very large chapters on national traditions. And the scholars who are experts in those national traditions were well known to David and Brian and had been publishing for many years. You know, when you think about writing a chapter on Renaissance Dutch cartography, when you think about writing a chapter on Renaissance French cartography, there are a handful of names, and these are the people who you are obviously going to ask. So they were approached very early and asked to contribute. And also, it was, I think, very wonderful for David and Brian to get these people on board, have them be part of the history. These are people you want writing for you. But unfortunately, they wrote their chapters, and then they sat while we finished Volume 2. So Volume 3 was definitely in the works before Volume 2 was anywhere near completion. It was a mixed bag. Many of the chapters we had were usable and had to simply be updated, and some of them had to be rewritten. Mm. It was mixed. And then there were many, many more that were newly sought after we really focused back on Volume 3. Mm-hmm. It seems to be jumping over. We do that a lot.
Yeah, it happens.
It happens.
But in the midst of Volume 3, David also passed away, so you had lost both of your founders. Can you talk about that a little bit, if you want?
That was really hard. I have a different perspective on it now that I am older than both David and Brian were when they died.
Oh, wow.
And it totally freaks me out. It was hard to lose both of them. Brian, so early, 1991, heart attack, something so quick and unexpected. David, almost similarly, I mean, being diagnosed with cancer and then really living less than a year after his diagnosis was really difficult for everyone. We did have a get-together, a sit-down with David. That was David and Roz, David's wife and wonderful rock for the project, and Beth Freundlich, who had been on the project for many years and still is as our financial whiz. We sat down, and David clearly wanted to talk about ways that we could continue the project and be sure the project gets done. So that was a very sad conversation to have, but it was also at a time when David accepted that he was not going to finish the project himself, and he wanted to know we were making plans to finish it. So, again, as with Brian, I can't even begin to process what the real effects of their deaths were, but I don't remember a time feeling hopeless about the project. I felt hopeless and sad about losing them, but I didn't feel hopeless and sad about the project, and I felt we had enough support and that it would get done.
Mm-hmm. So did you manage the rest of the editing? And
for Volume 3, David had edited everything. Mm-hmm. He had read everything, he had seen everything, and so what was left was a lot of the detail work that the staff on the project does anyway. Not the overall structural, here's what the content is going to be, here's how it's all going to fit together, but more of, are the references consistent and accurate? Have we got people's names spelled correctly? I mean, a lot of the detail stuff. And pulling together all the illustrations, which for Volume 3 was very, very time-consuming and much more difficult than earlier volumes because there were so many illustrations. The first year after David passed away, when we were doing a lot of this work, Jim Burt, who was the chair of the department at the time and also a friend of the project, stood in as PI, as chair of the geography department. He could be the PI on our grants, and he helped us get through that first year and helped us advertise to hire a director. We were able to hire Matthew and get him here that second year, which was really wonderful. And so he did a lot to help us wrap up Volume 3. Certainly a lot of work with illustrations. I mean, there is no end to the detail, you know, cropping pictures and making sure the captions and things are correct, making sure everything fits together. So that second year and the wrap-up to Volume 3, putting it into production, Matthew was here, Matthew Edney, who is still, who became the project director and still is the project director here in 2016. So that's how we finished Volume 3. And certainly I made use of other historians of cartography, many in Europe, who answered numerous questions I had, things that I would have asked David but couldn't, and they helped immensely.
That's great. So David passed away in 2004, and the volume came out in 2007, and then Matthew was hired around 2006?
Five or six. Would have been, you know, I'm so terrible. I work on a history project, and I'm terrible with dates. The year after David died, so from August 2004 to 2005, summer 2005, Jim Burt was the PI. So Matthew must have come in 2005, mm-hmm. late 2005, and was here on campus and worked as the project director here for 2 years, and then continued as project director but moved back to his permanent tenured position in, at the University of Southern Maine in Portland. So he now, and for the last many years, has directed the project from afar, but comes to Madison often and keeps tabs on us.
Mm-hmm. What was this? Did you have a long and drawn-out search, or was it really quick with a few candidates?
Few candidates. Mm-hmm. There were not a lot of people who were qualified to do the job. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be the intellectual head of a project this large, you have to be a scholar in the history of cartography, and there aren't that many of them. So the list was short, and Matthew was a great candidate, and I think fulfills the role of the intellectual head of the project very well. And there's all the PI duties as well, but I think of it more as directing the substance and content and direction of the books.
Mm-hmm. So Matthew had been the first illustrations editor here.
While he was working on his PhD.
Right.
So he was always going to go into academics, mm-hmm. But he was really a historian of cartography.
Right. But it's nice that he had the connection with the project earlier. But you've also had a lot of other long-term staff people, right?
We have. We've had, I've already mentioned the editors and co-editors and associate editors and assistant editors. Who've had a relationship with the project. But the staffing in terms of the administrative staff that does all of the work to keep the project running financially and within the university system, we've had a handful over these many years. You know, three probably long-term people who did that work and then a few wedged in between. And of course, now we have Beth Freundlich, who's been with us for, I should know this, maybe 15 years.
Like 17, I think.
No, or maybe more. And so that's the administrative side. And then in terms of the manuscript side and the people I work with most closely, we've had, I should look up the number, I don't know how many there are, but we've had graduate students who do the fact and reference checking and graduate students who do the illustration work for all the volumes, and several of them have stayed many years. But we've had many, and I'd have to say maybe there was one dud among them. We have had fantastic workers, as you would assume you would get when you're at a university like this and you have PhD candidates and students working on the project. And they've been exceptional. It never ceases to amaze me. And we've had some stay as long as 10 years. I'm sure their advisors, their PhD advisors weren't happy. But we've had them stay as long as, I guess Dana would be the longest. He's been more than 10 years. But we had several that stayed 10. And all excellent, made excellent contributions to the books.
That's great.
And translators and associate other staff, mm-hmm. who don't necessarily work in Science Hall, but help us out in other ways.
Right. There's so many moving parts to it.
There's a lot of moving parts.
Right. So you had hired Matthew in the mid-2000s, and you were working on volumes 4, mainly, and 6? You started with 6, right?
After 3 came out, we started... 4 and 6 were being worked on at the same time, not 5, which was going to be the last volume on the 19th century. Volume 6 on the 20th century was going to be edited by Mark Momineer. David asked Mark many years ago to help him edit and be a co-editor for Volume 6. Mark then was left as the sole editor when David passed away, but managed to, he's a very good editor and managed to pull that whole volume together. It became obvious as we were working through 4 and 6 that 6 was progressing much more rapidly. So the decision was made to focus on 6 and get 6 published first. There didn't seem to be any downside to that. Volumes 4, 5, and 6 were going to come out in the new format, which we call the encyclopedic format. And it made that made even more sense for Volume 6 to be first, because I've always felt that Volume 6 fit that format the easiest, having the shorter entries, more authors. And I think it worked out well for Volume 6, and it got people exposed to the new format before 4 and 5. I think 4 is the most difficult to fit into this new format, and I think it's partly because it follows Volume 3. And the topics and the traditions are difficult in this format, but it works. It's just harder to get it massaged into a cohesive volume. Volume 6, that was a little bit easier, I thought. Mm-hmm. So Volume 6 was completed first. Mark did a great job getting all of that material together. And we published Volume 6 in 2015. Mm-hmm. Shooting for 14, but made it by 15.
That's good.
And then now we've turned our attention back in the Madison office to Volume 4 mostly, but we're also progressing on Volume 5. We see the light at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. It's still a very long tunnel.
Right. What's the plan? What's the timeline?
The timeline is everything done by 2022, and we have been richly funded by many sources, most notably the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Science Foundation and several other foundations. Private individuals have been very generous with their support, and we just feel with this timeline we can get Volume 4 to press by next summer, which would be June 2017. Volume 5 is progressing as well. We have a staff member who's working exclusively on Volume 5 to keep those manuscripts moving through the office. Roger Kane is the editor for Volume 5, and I don't know when Roger came on board. I don't think David recruited Roger. I think Matthew did. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, David has had his hand in every volume and picked every editor and editorial team.
Did he reach out to Matthew to help with Volume 4?
Yes, he selected Matthew and Mary Pedley and Graham Burnett at Princeton to do Volume 4. They all agreed, and somewhere in the first or second year of planning, Graham decided to teach something he just could not fit into his schedule and couldn't do. So it was just Matthew and Mary. But they had met with David several times and made plans.
Mm-hmm. How did you all decide to shift from an from long scholarly articles in volumes 1 through 3 to an encyclopedia? It's very different.
It's very different. A lot has been said about it, and Matthew will be a good person mm-hmm. to explain it academically why. But basically, there are so many maps and so many traditions that this was a way to bring them into line and keep the books at an appropriate size. Volume 3 was supposed to be a 1 million word book. It was 1.3 million. And there are a lot of problems with going over by that amount in terms of producing the book, in terms of marketing the book, all of those things. So there was a concerted effort to keep volumes 4, 5, and 6 to 1 million words, which volume 6 is right in that ballpark. That's about the size they will be. And this new format was one way to keep that limit held. And it has to do with the burgeoning amount of material and a way to organize it such that it you're not having these national traditions that the chapters that go on for many, many pages and illustrate many maps. Decisions had to be made about what maps would be illustrated and how many. So it was to keep the volume size appropriate and organize the incredible amount of material. A lot more study of these maps. There's a lot more work that's been done. So for all those reasons.
Mm-hmm. So you had a format change over time with the project and the books. Has anything else changed significantly? I imagine, I mean, the internet has...
Totally changed.
Yeah.
Yes, when I think back on volume one and think about, as I mentioned, using a, you know, a word processing unit, CPT, and we had one printer, and it was so loud we had to build a special cover for it so it could be in the same office with us, because otherwise we couldn't hear ourselves think. And the change from volume one to now, even, who knows what it'll be like by the time we finish volume five at the end of the project, but the ability for us to do our Madison work, which I consider to be making sure that the footnotes and every citation is accurate, that's like one of the most important jobs that we have. Our ability to do that is increased greatly by being able to see many of these works through internet digital archiving and digitizing. It's an amazing change. So yeah, it makes our work easier. And then just having the computers to do the manuscripts. When we were working on volume one, I remember we finished volume one, we had moved to volume two, and when we were working on China, we often used Joseph Needham's Science and Civilization in China, and all I could think of was, how did he do this book with like carbon paper? He's got dual footnotes that are Chinese and English language, dual footnotes, and it just boggled my mind. And now I look back at what we were doing and think of it as that difficult and that tedious, the things that we needed to do. So yeah, I mean, in all the ways that you would imagine, it's easier, but there's still a lot to do.
Mm-hmm. But it hasn't been able to like make anything go faster, right?
There's doesn't still... seem like things go faster.
Right.
It just doesn't seem like things go faster. Right. There's always some new glitch. Either you're changing format, or you've got to deal with Korean characters, or you've got to figure out a way to get illustrations out of Russia, or there's always some thing that sucks up our time. So it's rewarding that they actually do get done.
Right, right. It's just time-consuming in and of itself. I mean, even if you have a digitized map available...
You have to look at it.
But you have to make... I mean, if it was cataloged improperly, I mean, that... You can go down rabbit holes looking for the right edition.
Because, have you ever gone down a rabbit
yeah.
hole? We've all gone down those rabbit holes.
Right, right. So it's helpful, but there are still issues then.
Yeah, it makes... It gives you confidence... When you want to change something, if you can see the artifact and see the map or see the book or see the atlas, even if it's in digital form, it gives you confidence to be able to say, yes, that quote is correct. Yes, we've spelled that person's name right. And as small as those things are, they're the foundation for the books. They're the foundation for what we say. You know, you can trust what you read here because it's been checked. So it's essential. And it was something that David and Brian felt from the very beginning that, I mean, they were concerned about how the history of cartography was going to be approached and its cultural and social and political implications and the people who made maps and why they made maps. Like, the content was important, but also they always felt that the reference function was essential and it had to be as accurate as we could make it. And yeah, there's always going to be mistakes, but it was important to them, and that was the foundation of the work that they did.
Mm-hmm. So you're in the last leg, basically, of the project.
It doesn't feel like it.
I know, but how do you feel? Are you comfortable with the progress that's being made?
I'm never comfortable with the progress that's being made. I feel that we're at a very critical juncture now because it's time for our funding sources to move on to other projects, and we need to finish what we've started. And I don't see any reason we won't finish it. I know that we will. But I feel pressure to stick to our timelines. And it's interesting that when David and Brian were around, we didn't talk very much about timelines because there was so much to do. I mean, it didn't matter if you were delayed a month or two or six or a year because there was a huge project ahead of us and we just worked through it as best we could. But now that we can see the end and now that we've had been so well supported for so many years, it's really time to, you know, put the foot to the pedal to the metal, as they say, and really finish everything up. So there's a lot to do, and people are scattered. Luckily, we have the internet and we have email. Editors are all over the world. But I'm confident it will happen, but I'm also overwhelmed sometimes at how much there still is to do. Mm-hmm. And you just go at it day by day.
Right.
And that's how David and Brian did it, and they managed to get through many volumes mm-hmm. and set us up for the rest. So
yeah,
that's where we're at.
Yeah. So volume 4 on the Enlightenment and volume 5.
And volume 5 on the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. By 2022.
By 2022. And, you know, the publication takes a long time. The University of Chicago Press, who have been our publishers for every volume and have done a fantastic job, they need 18 to 24 months from when we submit the manuscript until we see a book. And now that the books are published in full color, printing is often done overseas, not always, but there are a lot of issues. So we need to get our work done and get the books to the press so they can have their 18 to 24 months to publish them.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any concluding thoughts?
Concluding remarks. Shouldn't I have something that just winds everything up? And I was looking back on my notes, and I just think about the purpose of the oral history, and I hope that when the interviews for Matthew and Roz are added to this, people have a good sense of the person and the scholar that David was and the contributions he made to the field and the contributions he made to the university. And for me personally, having had the opportunity to do my thesis with him and then work with him for so many years, I feel very blessed and very lucky. And he and Brian both were, I think, a bit extraordinary. There are many extraordinary scholars, and I think they're among them. And I'm happy that we're recording a little bit about their lives and about what they did. Very extraordinary people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good note to end on. Thank you, Ju.
Thank you.